Greetings, friends, and welcome to episode 62 of the Innsmouth Book Club. You join us today in the foyer of the Gilman House, and we'll shortly be going upstairs to meet not one guest today, but we have a trio of guests for your delight. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Poynton.
And I'm the other one, Tim Mendes. Yeah, and we'll be joined by David Guffey, Richard Wilson and Mark Griffin from 30 Minutes Plus with H.P. Lovecraft podcast.
Okay, but before we tread these stairs, we've got a couple of news items. I just wanted to mention that as this episode goes out, we're going to be launching the next Kickstart for the next Innsmouth Gold Anthology. And we've got something rather special lined up for this one. It's going to be called The Pickman Papers. And it's going to be Lovecraft in the Dickensian era. So we've got some good stories coming in already. We'll be getting the Kickstart up with all our usual rewards of getting a copy of the book, T-shirt, that kind of stuff. So hopefully you'll take a look at that and give it some support.
Yes, and tickets have just gone on sale for the Innsmouth Literary Festival. You can get them on the website page now. We're still taking dealer tables. We've still got some available. So, yeah, go and check that out.
Yeah, we've been really pleased. I think, as we said last time, we've got some interesting traders coming already. And we've got pretty much a full panel of guests now as well.
Yeah.
Obviously, Ramsey Campbell being the guest of honour appearing on Zoom.
Indeed.
So yes, looking forward to that. All right, shall we go up those stairs?
Yeah, let's tread carefully, not wake up the other denizens of the hotel. Yeah, come on.
And here we are, room 328. Let's have a little knock on the door. Our special guests today, it's David, Mark and Richard. Welcome, chaps.
Hello, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
Is this your first visit to Innsmouth?
It is.
Yeah. I think I was here as a kid, but they tried to throw into the water, and you know, I have bad memories of being here.
You checked the side of your neck for gills lately.
Yeah. Mark just sank. They had to take him back out.
He's looking a little pale.
Yeah.
I don't think there's many people have good memories of Innsmouth, to be fair, even the ones that still live there. But, it's just that kind of place.
You know, we live close to Realfoot Lake, which is like one of the early settlements for the Innsmouth crowd. You know, there was like a character named Fishhead is an urbanist cub. Yeah, these mer creatures all blend together. Oh, which, you know, Fishhead's not too far from here, so we do have some run-ins with him.
Excellent.
Nice. So before we talk about the podcast, can we perhaps get into how each of you got into weird fiction and Lovecraft in particular?
Yeah, you can go first, David.
I was always just a fan of anything sci-fi or horror growing up. When I was a kid, I would sneak out of bed at night, and we only had like three channels we could get back then. And one of them out of Nashville would show, like every Friday night, would show horror movies or scary movies or whatever. As far as getting into Lovecraft, and Mark and Richard are probably tired of hearing this, but I first discovered Lovecraft in the the original Deities and Demigods for Dungeons and Dragons.
Nice.
And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, and I had to find out more about that. And eventually a very nice librarian ordered several copies of some of his books. They had just released some new paperbacks with those. Who's the artist, Mark? It's the really bizarre, creepy covers that they had out there in the early 80s.
Did all those little crap collections. I know you mean.
Yeah, I can't pronounce his name, but the Del Rey covers you're talking about.
Yeah, the great gray and red ones, weren't there? There's a lot of gray and red in them.
Those were my first Lovecraft book.
So she got those, and it was the rest is history. So Ivan, probably puzzlement of some of my college professors, I did a couple of research papers on Lovecraft.
Oh, nice.
And they did, I don't know, I think they were just sort of left wondering what the heck I was doing. So
that's an interesting thing, because of course Lovecraft scholarship is a big thing now. But I guess back at that time and before that, it was seen as pulp or whatever, not really right. Literature was
a pioneer, you know? David.
Well, back then there was only a couple of things you could even find, and those were both Joshi books of criticism and essays. And we're talking 1985, 86. So this is a few years ago.
And that Deities and Demigods, I can't imagine what sort of prices that commands now for copies of that, because it wasn't out for very long, was it, that edition? It got hit with Lovecraft and the Elric stuff as well, I think, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm, it did. Yeah, they released a second edition pretty quickly. And yeah, I have no idea what it's worth right now, but it's, a couple hundred dollars at least, I would guess.
Okay, Mark, so what's your superhero origin story?
Poor villain, yeah. I would kind of pick up things along the way. My parents necessarily didn't want me getting involved in science fiction, fantasy, and all that, so I always had to sneak it in. And they did take me to see Star Wars, when I got to see it on premiere night, and I was forever warped by that. And so I was, and then they're showing the comic books of them. That just freaked me out. I was like, you mean it's not just a movie, but there's a comic book too, telling the rest of the story? And so kind of evolved from that. And then there was Star Trek. And then Lovecraft came pretty late, by the 80s as well, when I kept picking up old Fangoria magazines, and they always would mention, the stories of Lovecraft. And I'm like, well, who's this Lovecraft they keep talking about?
Yeah, I used to read those as well. I still get Fangoria to this day. Yeah, it's one of the...
It's still
oh, yeah, yeah. I picked one up from W.H. Smith's the other day. So
I love that magazine. That and Starlog. Those like the magazines to get. And eventually they released the Del Reys, and so I started just snatch them up and everything, just read them. And then finally I got to see The Reanimator. And it took a long time, to read The Reanimator story, because it wasn't included in the Del Rey collection. So I had to there was a Frankenstein omnibus and they had it in there. And so I bought that volume just for that one story.
Nice.
And were you into gaming at that time as well, or was that not your thing?
Yeah, I did some gaming. We had some group of friends. We'd get together and we'd play every Sunday night at the library, and Dungeons and Dragons. But I don't think I was too familiar with Lovecraft then. We'd have most of the time we just fought standard monsters, like the orcs and dragons and stuff like that. We didn't involve any Lovecraftian creatures, anything like that.
Sure. Yeah.
But. In Richard?
Similarly, yes. When I was a kid and then as a teenager as well, most of my interests had very Lovecraft influences that I wasn't aware of. The Venn diagram of, Doctor Strange comics and heavy metal and goth music and Dungeons and Dragons and horror movies, stuff like that. Wait a minute, the source code for a lot of this.
Yeah.
And then discovered, and similarly, those nicely packaged, those Del Rey books are my first, introduction into the collected works, of H.P. Lovecraft at that point, at which point I finally kind of realized this, that, the influence he had on so many things I was already interested in.
Yeah.
I think I saw a TV version of From Beyond first. So he was edited. So I didn't get to see a lot of the good scenes until later on.
Actually, that's kind of uneventful.
Yeah.
Quite heavily edited, I should imagine. There's not much left. It's like a 10-minute film.
Yeah, they'd just be talking about, we turned the resonator on earlier.
Yeah.
And, something bad happened, but you guys missed it because we cut to commercial.
Okay. Commercial happens and he comes back and Bob Crampton's half naked. You're like, what have I missed?
Yeah. What happened here? I feel like I missed a few.
Damn it.
It seems at that time was, I don't know if would it be the second big sort of Lovecraft revival, or I'm not sure what the timing would be. I guess August Derleth sort of launched him again in the 40s, 50s maybe. We had the sort of 60s paperback boom coming in, perhaps into the 70s. But the 80s, particularly with the advent of gaming, really seemed to bring Lovecraft out again.
Yeah. Interestingly, I've been doing a lot of research about video games, and the first Lovecraftian video games came out in 1987. And from what I can see, it was basically because it started with Reanimator and then From Beyond in 86. That was basically, I think it was those films that kind of kick-started more interest in Lovecraft. So other people sort of went, oh, there's a good thing. So from no Lovecraftian video games, you ended up with 5 in 1 year. So,
today's glut of, many, many Lovecraft influenced games.
Oh, yeah.
No, it's just had really search hard to find a Lovecraft game. And now, You can swing a dead cat and hit one.
Yeah.
That's probably part of one of the games, I think, isn't it?
Yeah. Pretty much.
Yeah, that's your weapon.
There was a cool game we played, Eldritch Horror. You know,
is there a dead cat in
there? I don't think there's a dead cat in there, but you know, it had some interesting weapons in there. Yeah. You know?
So how did the podcast come about? Have you guys known each other for a while, or how did you come to make a podcast? And then why choose Lovecraft specifically?
Me and David have known each other for quite some time. And Richard would come to the library, and he was asking for like some type of like book club, you know, group. And so eventually we decided to form one, you know, for speculative fiction. And we kind of like, you know, we'd meet that way and talk about all different types of speculative fiction, not just like just Lovecraft. And but then COVID happened, and like seemed like everything else is an origin story now in this day and age.
Yeah.
And I did do some remote working, but I did have an awful lot of free time. And so I found an old biography of Lovecraft by L. Sprank de Camp. And I'd never read it. I've had all these decades, and finally decided to get around just reading it. And it renewed my interest in Lovecraft.
Yeah.
And so I was doing some online programs for the library, and I decided, well, let's do one on Lovecraft. And I thought about just doing one, but then I decided there's really so much about him, and I could just do a whole series of them, and it just kind of evolved from there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I asked David about being involved with it, because he'd been pestering me about doing a podcast. And so he jumped aboard, and he wanted someone else to be involved too. And he says, like, why not Richard? I was like, yeah, I want to get Richard involved. And so, and as they say, the rest is history.
Now, 3 years later, maybe.
Yes.
Not 3 years. How many episodes are you up to now?
Right off the bat of my head, I can't remember, but we've been doing one a month. So it's about, so B3 is about 36 episodes in.
Excellent.
In June.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. I'm not sure which one we're on right now.
And we started going over our original 30-minute allotment of time quite a bit. Hence the plus.
Yeah, originally the title was 30 minutes of H.P. Lovecraft.
Strict cutoff of 30 plus.
And we never could keep that. So I decided just to add a little plus sign to it.
It's quite tough, isn't it, though, keeping it in that sort of time, especially we've found sometimes we've had the shortest story and we think, oh, that will give us 40 minutes. But you start getting into some background things and some tangents. And I think, was it the Great God Pan, Tim, that we did? Ended up to 2 hours or something?
Yeah. Yeah, it was the Great God Pan. We went off, because obviously you've got all the stuff like Victorian morality and all this other mythology and all that stuff. And it was like, how long have we been talking now? It's about 2 hours. Bloody hell. Yeah, it just happens.
Yeah, it was like, when you get a good interview, you know, like you want to keep it going. I don't want to like end. It's like, no, we got to end it now, especially when, like, you know, it's going so well.
Yeah.
And so I just let them, you know, flow like they are and don't worry about a time limit.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah.
There have been a few that, like, you know, they get misled and think it's just gonna be 30 minutes. I do have to remind them, you know, this, we do go a little bit over.
Well, speaking of interviews, you had ST Joshi on, I see, quite early on. How did you, was it a case of just getting in touch with him and asking him sort of thing?
He was our first interview that we had for our podcast.
Nice.
And I had been contacting him. I had gotten a hold of the letters that Lovecraft had written. And I asked if he had like a master index. So that way, you know, I didn't have to like go through all the books, you know, to find out, you know, when he talked about a certain subject or talked about somebody, and they hadn't done anything like that. And so basically I asked him for like copies of all the index so I could like make one big master copy and all that, so I can go through them all and everything. And you know, it's quite a little task to do because I can't just necessarily put them all together in a Word document because it's just such a big file. It won't let me do an ABC order right by then. But I have to do them all separately by A, B, C, D, and then, like, you know, then put them all together. So it takes a little bit more work. But it's very helpful. It helps me, like, you know, do quick research when I want to find, like, you know, something he may have talked about. I can just like look for it right then and there.
Yeah.
But he was so easy to talk to. Josie was the one I was into talking to about the whole thing. So so I decided, well, I'm just asking him to be interviewed because I know he's been interviewed by several different things and I figured he'd jump at it. He seems to be quite open for it or friendly to it, I should say. And so it's like, he said yes. So we did the interview quite well and quickly.
Excellent.
It went for quite a while. I mean, we evidently had a lot to talk about. It seemed like it lasted. That was one of our longer ones, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was, I don't know if it was quite 2 hours, but it seemed like it felt like it.
Yeah.
I think it was like maybe like an hour and 30 minutes, you know, but it was one of our longer ones. Bill Cavalier, that seemed to went on for a while. The one with Conan.
Oh yeah.
That may have been about 2 hours. He was very talkative and all that.
He was very happy to talk.
Yeah.
About it. Oh, is that your Robert E. Howard days?
He's involved the Robert E. Howard days, and wow. He's like, you know, like, and where they have Warren Cross Plains, Texas, and so every year they have like a big festival for like, you know, Robert E. Howard, and so like, and he was willing to talk about, you know, him. And I asked very few questions. Most of the time, he just, like, you know, sit and just do all the talking. You know? It's like the ideal interview, you know.
Have you guys been down to that? Is that relatively close to you? Or am I showing my geographical ignorance?
Texas is a little bit of a drive, and just being in Texas is a bit of a drive. Nothing's close. You know, it may look that close on the map, but they're like that far apart. You
know? Once you get to Texas, you realize you aren't even halfway there.
You have not begun your journey yet.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's so much, there's vastness between them. You know, it's not like, you know, some place where you can go to, where you can stop up, go to another town, or maybe like just those towns. There's nothing else between them.
Wow.
So it's like, I've been aiming to go there. I haven't gone there yet, but I do plan on going there sometime because I would like to attend the Robert E. Howard days.
Yeah. It's always been a bucket list thing for me. Absolutely. Just the thought that you can go and stand in that room. I don't think it's the original typewriter. Maybe it is. I don't know. But just something about being in that place is very evocative, I think.
Yeah, that's what they want to do. I want to see the town, you know, and their library there has quite a collection of Robert E. Howard stuff as well. Mm. And I'm curious about they have a guy who retells all the boxing stories, and I saw a video of him, and he really gets into it. So I'm actually very curious about his boxing stories as well.
Yeah, I think people don't always appreciate what a sort of wide range of genres he wrote in, really, Howard. I mean, I suppose he's primarily a sort of adventure writer, really, and whatever he was writing about, he just brought that same sort of vividness to.
Yeah, he definitely knew how to make something very action-packed, you know, when you read.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't get bored reading his stories. No. You know, and one of his stories probably has, like, one of my favorite of his has probably one of the dumbest names, but I really love it. It's like Pigeons from Hell.
One of my favorites too. Yeah, absolutely love that story. But like most of his stuff is like a shot of adrenaline right to the head, isn't it? This gets you all fired up. It's not sort of like subdued bedtime reading, is it?
Yeah, you it's definitely not nighttime reading. You know, you want to stay up. You read that stuff. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And that had a fairly decent adaptation as well, didn't it? Pigeons from Hell.
Indeed, yeah.
I've not seen it, so, you know, it's like it's...
Yeah, I'm trying to think what series it was now.
Hang on 1 minute.
Is it one of the Boris Karloff series, I think?
I think it may have been Thriller. Yeah, it was. Boris Karloff's Thriller, Pigeons from Hell, 1961.
61.
Yeah.
That's probably on YouTube, because I think a lot of those episodes are on YouTube.
I think it might be. Yeah,
if I can find the link, I'll put it up in the show notes below, because it's definitely worth seeing. It's a good adaptation, which is a rarity if we talk about Lovecraft, Smith, and even Howard. Well, I mean, we could mention the Cabinet of Curiosities if we want to.
We're talking about the good stuff.
Yeah,
we're talking about the good ones.
We don't have anything nice to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of what we were talking about.
If you want to talk about the Graveyard Rats one, we'll talk about that, but let's just pretend that the Lovecraft adaptations didn't happen.
Footage missing.
What about the Night Gallery Pickman's model?
I much preferred that to the Cabinet of Curiosities. It was camp as all hell, but I actually really enjoyed that one. At least it stuck to the story, you know.
I'm with you there.
Just the very, very strange ghouls.
Yeah, that's. I always felt it seems like that, you know, for Pickman's model, you almost have to almost like see the monster, because you know it's that you know your imagination goes into, like, you know, what you think the monsters look like and all that, and whatever horrendous thing you think of is not going to match, you know, what the film crew makes and stuff like that.
Yeah. Which is the challenge of any Lovecraftian adaptation, isn't it, really?
Seem like he'd be better for like radio, you know, sometimes like, for radio type of thing.
Well, I think the best adaptations have been the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society Dark Adventure Radio Theatre audio dramas. They are by far the best adaptations, hands down, as far as I'm concerned. Because they've just got it all. They've got the atmosphere, the acting's great, the plots are great. You know, it's just really good fun.
Have you seen their version of Call of Cthulhu that is a silent movie?
I love that. I was a big fan of their version of Whisper in the Darkness as well. I got a kick out of the biplane scene, actually. I know some people didn't like that, but I did.
Yeah, they do some good stuff.
Well, it's nice because they weren't afraid to adapt it, but I think the adaptation, it was in keeping with, you know. Because again, the other issue, well, you look at something like From Beyond, it's, what is it, like a 4 or 5 page story or something? It's very, very short. If you're going to make that into a 90-minute movie, you've got to put something in, I suppose.
Stretch it out a bit.
Barbara Crampton in a kinky outfit, you know?
Kinky Barbara sure Crampton, works for me.
It's a good way to keep attention going and all that.
So I was a teenager at the time. Of course, I appreciated it.
Even though they did stretch out From Beyond, it didn't feel padded. You know, it felt like it was a necessary storyline that they did.
Or adding additional characters to pull away from the source material or anything like that.
I think
it's if you keep the atmosphere, isn't it? Is the all important thing probably with Lovecraft.
I think one of the best Lovecraft adaptations is one that was adapted from a story, but it was a John Carpenter's, you know, like From the Mouth of Madness.
It's definitely
And a lot of people have said that The Thing as well is probably the best Lovecraftian movie. I mean, that hits all the buttons, doesn't it?
Yeah, it definitely feels like something that would come like, you know, like a sequel from The Mounts of Madness or something like that.
So we've got Robert E. Howard in Texas and we've got Lovecraft on the East Coast in Providence. Have any of you been over to Providence at all or to the Necronomicon or anything like that?
Trying to go next year to it because they do it every other year and so next year be it. And so I'm going to try to go to that. And I've been to there's Bangor, Maine, you know, Stephen King's territory.
Oh yeah. Nice. Yeah.
You know, it's like, he has a house like you expect Stephen King to have, you know, it's kind of like this like gothic looking, you know, multi-story house. You know, it looks almost like a castle type of thing. And
it'd be really disappointing, wouldn't it, if you turned up and it was all sort of glass and modern.
Yeah.
It'd be really disappointed, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it'd be a white suburban, you know, like one-story house, you know, the white picket fence.
One interesting fact is Stephen King actually came to Russellville, where we live. This was about 25 years ago. He was riding through on some sort of tour, going to small independent bookstores, and he was on his motorcycle, and he stopped in at one of the barbecue joints in town, and they used to have a picture of him up in there. I don't know if it's still there or not, but
they still do.
Oh, do they? Okay, I hadn't seen it lately, but so Stephen King came to Russellville.
There you go.
I was working for the newspaper at the time when that happened, and I was not there that day, but the editor was there. We're like a very small newspaper, and it's like we had to like actually lay out the paper, like cut it out, put wax on it, and stick it onto like you know a big broadsheet.
Old school. It was like
pre-computers and all this we were doing going on.
He did it by candlelight.
Yeah, but the editor, the restaurant called the newspaper, said Stephen King's here, and our publisher had never heard of Stephen King, which I find really hard to believe, but. And she's like, no, we got a paper to get out. We don't know, go picture some writer. And she was like talking about like, you know, said some writer named Stephen King is here. Our editor heard that. He was not going to miss an opportunity to meet Stephen King in Russellville, Kentucky. So he left. Right, on all that. And he went and met him and he could not take an in-focus picture of him. He was so nervous about meeting him. All the pictures of him are blurry.
Brilliant.
Oh, nice.
And our publisher still didn't really understand the significance of Stephen King. You know, she said, kept calling him that writer.
That writer.
You know, that writer, you know.
That guy you were all excited about.
Yeah, but that was basically the talk of the town for about a week. You know, it's like having Stephen King in our town. And he just ate lunch. That's all he did. You know.
He always strikes me as being a nice sort of guy, though. He seems, you know, seems okay. Always seems approachable.
Seems like
to, yeah, fans and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, he seems to have, except I guess we talk about Stanley Kubrick or something, you know. Yeah, but he seems to have been really well liked. Everybody really liked him. And I don't think he was expecting anybody to recognize him in Russellville, but, you know, and the waitress did right off the bat.
I like the fact he just rode into town on his motorbike and went to a barbecue place. I mean, you could always write a country song, couldn't you? The day Stephen King rode into town, sort of thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Didn't you have an episode with Lovecraft and sort of Nashville type songs or something? Was it?
We had the Arkham Hillbilly.
Yeah,
and he does like country songs, and he's another Brit, and Darcy Sullivan's his real name, and he used to time with like all the for some reason he got inspired to do country songs about Lovecraft, and so that's what he did.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I approve of that. That's brilliant.
Yeah. Well, you got to hear he has amazing lyrics. Yeah. I mean, he really knows how to make a song, and he makes them rhyme. He calls them true rhymes. He doesn't like fudge it, you know, like where it's kind of almost sounds like the word and all that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he has one about, what was it? Tahihi.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whatever it is.
Yeah. That kind of like, yeah. Elvis in Hawaii type of
appeal
to it
or
whatever. Yeah. The lyrics are extremely dark.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you like listen to it, it sounds like such a like a really pleasant, like nice going song, but if you know what the story's about, you know it's not going to end well for the person, you know. Yeah.
Mind you, that's country songs in general, a lot of the time.
Oh yeah, a lot of them are really dark, aren't they? Yeah.
And then a fun one for the kids about Krampus that, because it was right around Christmas time, I think.
That's true. I forgot about that one.
Yeah, that was really good.
Yeah, Krampus is like a very catchy song, and I'm surprised it's not like, you know, playing on radios. Yeah,
that hasn't gotten more play than it has.
Yeah, it that definitely needs to be like, you know, everybody's like Christmas, you know.
You've got to music. Add it to your Christmas playlist.
Yeah. Reminds me, the HPLS did a couple of Christmas albums, didn't they? A scary solstice and an even scarier solstice.
Yes.
And the one that always stuck in my head in that, well, there was two. There was Freddy the Red-Brained Migo, you know, had a very slimy brain. You know? And then there was Harley got devoured by the undead to Santa got run over by a reindeer, you know. Harley got devoured by the undead, lurking down in some forgotten tomb.
Oh, it's awesome.
Genius. Someone did a parody, you know, with my grandmother got run by a reindeer. So
yeah,
wow. And who is this group again?
Oh, it's the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society.
Okay,
yeah.
It's beginning to look a lot like Fishmen. Was another one.
Yeah, yes.
there's a really nice little video out for that as well. What is it about Lovecraft that attracts this kind of thing? I wonder, because it's something we talk about a lot. In one sense, Lovecraft is very bleak and cosmic horror, and we're all going to go mad or die, or go die and then go mad, whichever way around. But there seems to be such a strong vein of humour running through it in so many ways as well, which I think Lovecraft is often not given credit for, is seen as very Puritan almost. But when you get into the letters, you realise he was having a laugh a lot of the time.
Yeah, he had a very good sense of humor.
Yeah, you've only got to look at them return addresses, haven't you? Blimey!
Yeah.
Some of them are just done. Some are genius.
Josie said one of the biggest surprise, you know, that when you started like, you know, researching Lovecraft, is like how much of a sense of humor he had. Because you know, it's like before I started reading the biography during the COVID era, you know, I had this preconceived notion of that Lovecraft's like this recluse, like he lived in like a shack or something, had like a typewriter. He pecked, you know, with only two fingers, you know, type of thing. And you find out that that's not even close to being right about him. You know, he's like, he was more of a traveler than, you know, some of his other, you know, mates.
You know? Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, one of my favorite stories is the one you told me, Rob, about when Clark Ashton Smith's lady friend's daughter went out to Providence and he took her around and creeped her out in the graveyard.
Yes, started putting on vampire voices and going. Oh, wow.
I've never heard that one. Yeah. That's cool.
I think he took it to the church where, like, where Poe's like a mistress.
It's where Poe's buried. Yeah.
He really loved that. He really loved that church, and he did like some acrostics with some other people, you know, there, all in the name of Edgar Allan Poe. So he definitely loved. A lot of the old creepy houses in Providence, and would like visit them at night and use them for the basis of his stories.
Were there any other facts you found out about Lovecraft that sort of surprised you or confirmed any thoughts you had?
How much of a traveler he was the biggest surprise. You know, he actually came to Tennessee, which is fairly close to us. And so I was a little bit going, you know, I was like, yeah. He was very interested in going to Mammoth Cave, which is in Kentucky. And in fact, he did such a good job. Beast in the Cave is based on, you know, Mammoth Cave.
Right.
He did such a good job of writing it that the people at Mammoth Cave think he actually visited, you know, there.
Wow.
Because they say he got so many things right in there. And so, you know, that was, you know, little things like that is like really kind of impressed me. You know, it seemed like the geography was a really important element to him. You know, if he was going to write about something, he would try to get as accurate as he could, you know, kind of like Imprisoned the Pharaohs that he did for Houdini. You know, he tried his best to get like the geography of, you know, of Egypt right, you know, when he was writing that story. And so make it feel realistic.
Oh, yeah. Place and setting are another character in his stories.
Yeah. I mean, that's something we've discussed before, isn't it? That while he doesn't have any, put aside from Carter, he doesn't really have any recurring characters except Arkham and Innsmouth. They're his returning characters. Yeah.
Aside from the monsters, of course, you know.
Well, that's different.
Yeah. Oh, of course.
Yeah. It's like, you know, because like Shadowbur Innsmouth, you know, the town we're in right now, you know, that we can, you almost feel like you can read that book and like you'll use as a map, you know, to move around the city and everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's an incredible piece of world building in that sense, isn't it? That given that we're not, we associate world building with fantasy more and more, I suppose. And even your Dunsany's and that kind of stuff. But Lovecraft seemed to, I don't know if he was the first writer to do that, but inventing your own geography or your own towns and villages in such a detailed and evocative way. Seemed to be quite a new thing at the time.
I don't know if he invented it, but he definitely made it into a work of art. You know, when he
yeah, because I guess Arthur Machen was setting things in real places, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Perhaps listeners out there could let us know. Can you think of any writers from that time or previous who had such rich settings for their work that were set in the real world? I mean, obviously the Hyborian age is very richly drawn and that sort of thing.
But Yoknapatawpha County by William Faulkner, he had several novels that were set in that same location.
Yeah. And I mean, Ramsay Campbell sort of did the same thing in England. He invented his own setting in England.
Yes.
Was that on Derleth's advice? You're saying to him? Yeah. Because I think originally he was trying to set things in Arkham and stuff.
Yeah, he'd wrote what became Inhabitants of the Lake. It was a short story collection. And he sent it to Ramsay Campbell. Ramsay Campbell sent it to August Derleth. And Derleth said, yeah, I really like it. I'll publish it if you take it away and you set it in England. Because you've obviously never been to New England. So, you know, it's not coming across as authentic. So, because he'd set it all in Arkham and Innsmouth and Kingsport. So he basically went and took it away and created Britchester and Goatswood, basically his own version set in the Severn Valley, like just south of Merseyside, which is where he's from. So, yeah, that's why it comes across so well.
Mm.
So, yeah, it was basically August Derleth's prompting that he did it.
Yeah, there's like there's a lot of August Derleth stories I don't care for when he set them in New England. I like his more Wisconsin stories.
I'm the same. Yeah. His Wisconsin stuff was really good. Like, I just, I've not really read any of his like Sac Prairie stuff, but his horror that he set in Wisconsin, his, even his Cthulhu mythos he set in Wisconsin, is leaps and bounds above the stuff that he set in New England.
Yeah. It's like a, it seemed like he was just like almost like a bump, you know, just coasting and just riding on the tails of Lovecraft. And it seemed like he got a little bit more inventive, you know, when he like at least set him in his own state.
Yeah.
So how would Kentucky work as a setting? Have you got some good local folklore? You mentioned the mammoth caves, was it already? That sounds pretty good. Fishhead was a local author, is that right?
We have the Bell Witch, and it's one of the famous ghost stories. And it's actually across the state line in Adams, but we're so close to each other, you know, that they're kind of like kissing cousins, you know. And so we have like the Bell Witch, and we have a little ghost story here about the woman in the window, and and the ghost train,
right?
And so we got a few little things, and we got a mention in the first Halloween movie by John Carpenter. John Carpenter grew up in Bowling Green, which is the next county over, and he threw in a lot of hometown references in his films. And so he mentions a Charlie Bowles from Russellville, and that was a real person who ran a movie theater here. And Charlie Bowles and John Carpenter did not get along. And so if you watch that part, he's kind of implies that, you know, Charlie Bowles is a mass murderer, but the story ends for he can never say what is happening.
And that is how artists get their revenge.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Every town's got one, haven't they?
Well, if you watch the original version of The Fog, Adrienne Barbeau is on the radio talking about the fog moving around the town. And she says it's on Russellville Road. It's near Hospital Hill. These are all like local or nearby places to us.
Nice.
Yeah, mentions Clay Street, which had the famous brothel in Bowling Green. That was like that. You know, but she wrote her memoirs about her. So she got really popular after she did the memoirs. And had a red velvet cover on everything. It came with a wooden nickel. And the wooden nickel was like used as like a little like a symbol for people to come in, you know. They had a wooden nickel. They knew they were like, you know, like, they were safe. You know?
The oldest profession in the world, and then the second oldest is probably people writing about it. So
yeah, the romantics or why?
Or certainly poets. Anyway,
drugs or nookie, wasn't it? That's pretty much the two subjects.
Yeah. Sex and drugs and rock and roll, man.
Exactly.
It's like Godard said, all you need is a girl and a gun to make a movie.
And I noticed one of your episodes is on folklore and Lovecraft as well, which is a connection that fascinates us because it's definitely something that Lovecraft drew on, but then not to the extent of going sort of supernatural with it.
Yeah, it's one of those things, almost like a contradiction. You know, he's known for being cosmic horror, but at the same time, he also dealt into like, you know, folk horror. You know, like The Shunned House was kind of like based on kind of the vampire panics that were going on in New England. And The Unnameable was a story that he came across in one of Cotton Mather's books. So he would like take these stories that he would find and kind of like, you know, turn them into cosmic events. It was weird how you could like, you know, ground something in reality, but at the same time, make it like, you know, almost like, you know, esoteric, you know?
I'm thinking things like your lurking fear. Yeah. That's almost your almost cliche trope now of going out into the woods and there's the weird cannibal family kind of thing, isn't it? Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah. And it's the hills have eyes, isn't it?
He was the trendsetter, you know, he started that, you know. Which I don't know if that's a really good thing to start being a trend on, you know.
And obviously the Dunwich horror comes from, it's inspired by Macken, and, you know, and that comes from Welsh folklore. Yeah. So there we go. We got a bit of the transatlantic thing going on there as well.
And there were some altars too in New England states that he based them on that are believed to have been like done by the Native Americans at a bunch of times.
I was quite surprised to find out about that fairly recently, that, you know, there's quite a few standing stone sites over in the States. Well, all across the States, really.
Yeah, there was
I don't know why it would be a surprise to me, but perhaps it's like, you know, us Brits, we've got Stonehenge and Avebury and all these incredibly ancient places, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, so is everyone else.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but Stonehenge is pretty cool. I've been to it. I really like Stonehenge.
All right.
That and Newgrange. Nice. I love Newgrange.
Oh, Newgrange is great. Yeah.
And, I believe a lot of my ancestors probably came from there, so I have more of a spiritual connection with Newgrange.
Excellent.
But a lot of the standing stones here, a lot of the white Americans couldn't accept the fact that they could have been built by, you know, Native Americans. So they came with the myth of the Welsh Indians. That built them.
Welsh Indians. Wow. I've not heard that before.
There was like this lost tribe of Welshmen who came and got stranded here. And, you know.
Oh, my God.
That's brilliant. Yeah. I can just imagine them all turning up.
Yeah, it's the only evidence that they were here.
Yeah. In fact,
that's lovely.
In fact, when Lewis and Clark were doing their trek, to the western portion of the United States, one of the things they were trying to find out is if the Mandan tribe was actually part of the Welsh tribe. There was a rumor, you know, that they were part of the Welsh Indians. So that was like, you know, they're able to find that out.
That's amazing.
Yeah. That's brilliant. I could just imagine them making Pontefract cakes and rare bits.
That's like Tom Jones, New England.
Tidy in there.
I mean, surely there's more of a case for Vikings than that come across the world.
Yeah, but it got pretty deep. You know, like, they find, like, you know, armor from them and stuff like that. There's always these reports they find, like, money and, you know, like, Welsh armor and stuff like that. But, you know, when it comes actually showing it, you know, it always vanishes, you know.
It's like them TV shows, isn't it, when they go on the trail of Bigfoot or something. It's like, last week we saw it. Now we're out there with the cameras and we're not going to see a damn thing.
There's some vague evidence of, you know, see how the grass is crushed down here. That's this great path.
You know, a little hair caught in like a briar patch or something like that.
Could this be where he was?
Have you got any Bigfoot legends local to you, or Sasquatch or anything?
We do. I've met a few people who claim that they have actually seen Bigfoot. And it hurt him. Apparently he has a very distinct cry. But he's never caught any trail cams. And they say that this is the reason they give, you know, that he can see the ultraviolet beam. And so he avoids it. And all that.
I love the excuses. They're the best bit about it.
It's enhanced senses. Bullshit
that people come out with is brilliant. Well, it's because he can see the light angling off that branch over there. What?
You kind of wonder, even if he did see the light, would that be enough to him just avoid it? I mean, it's like, did he know even what it was?
Moonbeam.
Does beg the question. I just wonder what the noise would be if Bigfoot trod on a Lego. That would be an interesting.
Yeah.
That's what they should do, is put Lego out around the forest and then.
Like scatter a whole bunch of them out there and so you can pick up the cries in. We have an area that's we have no natural lakes in Kentucky. They're all man-made, and we have an area called Land Between Lakes, and they're supposed to be the beast of LBL, they call it. And I know somebody who's recorded the sound of it and all that, and I've heard it.
Ah, interesting.
That's a story he says, you know, that, you know.
Right.
Is that the guy from over in Todd County that works for the Todd County schools, or is that someone else?
It's someone. He lives like in close to Bowling Green.
Oh, okay. There was a guy that supposedly got some video of him or saw him a while back, and he is not a teacher necessarily. Maybe he's one of the sports coaches at Todd County, which is one county over, a school district, one county over from us. I don't know. I can't think of the guy's name, but is that not familiar to you at all? Is that?
It's this is probably a younger person. He's probably in his 30s.
Okay.
He goes out hunting. And
gotcha.
And he just happened to have his phone out and record the sound. So, you know, I don't know how it came about, but you know, that's what he believes.
And, gotcha.
I can't help thinking of that episode of Father Ted, the Beast of Craggy Island, and so he's rigged up the stereo. There's speakers in the tree to scare the sheep. <It's> just...
Having said that, nighttime has a strange effect on sound or your perception of sound. And we had, when we first moved in here, we're pretty much in the countryside. I went out one night to let the cat in or something, and there was something screaming in the field. And I mean, like, real sort of, thinking, Jesus, what's that? Turned out it was a very small muntjac deer.
Oh, they do make some weird ass noises, they do.
And then another one was responding from three fields over the back. So you got this, just shouting to each other. But the first time you hear it, it's all, what, the invasion, the zombie invasion has started or something. Really weird sound.
Well, the urban foxes, because I live in a tower block. So I'm five floors up and there's a courtyard at the back. So sound echoes really bizarrely. And there was an urban fox. And you know, they make that weird sort of like, kind of noise, right? And I was lying in bed and I was like, what the fuck is that? It was like booming, and I had the wind, because it was summer, so I had the windows open, and it was like, what the hell is going on? I thought somebody was getting murdered on the, like, the, one of the other room flats or something.
I mean, I've seen a few foxes. I've never heard any of them.
They make the strangest noise. You'd expect them to make sort of dog-like noises, right? But they don't. They make some weird kind of like, kind of noises. Really odd.
And we're supposed to have some Black Panther sightings as well.
Oh, big cats.
Not Wakanda Black Panther, but you know, the actual, like,
Yeah, that seems to be quite a thing over here at the moment as well. So areas like Dartmoor and that sort of thing.
Well, the Beast of Bodmin, that's a big cat.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Beast of Bodmin Moor. Yeah.
There's always rumours of people letting pet tigers go and that kind of stuff. I think when they changed the law, it was a few years back now. Is it the Dangerous Animals Act?
Dangerous Animals Act, yeah.
I used to live in East London, and there was a pet shop around the corner. You could buy chimpanzees, you could buy a tiger. Wow. You know, it was just madness, really. And obviously now it's all more strictly controlled. But I think maybe people who had them and didn't want to pay all the extra money to just chuck them out probably took it for a drive out into the country and shoot it out the car.
Well, you do get strange colonies of things, because they were all from, like, the Victorians when they had their menageries and things like that. And things would just escape, you know. So you get weird-ass colonies of weird things in weird places. And it's all the fault of Victorians. It's great. It's like up here, there's a place called Ditching Beacon, and there's supposed to be hellhounds who live up there. It's some weird, some big wild dogs. But again, nobody's ever managed to get a picture of them. But well, apparently they're there.
Hounds of Tyndalos.
Exactly, yeah. You've got one of them in your back room, haven't you?
Yes, it's been very quiet tonight.
Yeah. Y'all need to do a special where you need to go out there and try to find the hellhounds.
Track down all these.
But then the other aspect of that, I always think, with Lovecraftian creatures in particular, is just look at what's living in the sea and what things are being discovered quite regularly in the sea. And let's just hope they stay in the sea, and I'm never going in the sea because I don't want to bump into that.
Oh, wow.
It's such a vastness. You know, it's like, I don't think they've ever found a live giant squid. They know they exist.
The colossal squid. There's been a couple wash up, but they've never actually... I've actually watched a documentary on them. They managed to get, like, a really blurry image of one, but the vehicle that they had couldn't go down far enough, but they got, like, it was like, there it is, it's there, but we can't get any closer because the thing will just go, it'll just collapse in upon itself, you know. It's mental, isn't it? It's like the Mariana Trench and things like that. It's like, God knows what's lurking down there.
They're probably wise creatures. They see humans and go, like, no, 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 I'm not having anything with them, you know.
Did you blame them?
Yeah.
But it does make you wonder, with Lovecraft's well-known sort of fear of the sea and hatred of seafood and that kind of stuff, what sort of process do you think was going on there?
Yeah, that's going to be really weird to live in a town like that, you know, where, like, you know, you hate seafood and, you know, sea life, and you live so close to it, you know?
Yeah. And pretty much everywhere you go, serving chowder.
Yeah.
you'd be a bit screwed, really, wouldn't you?
I imagine he didn't eat very much. You know, he's like,
no.
Didn't get invited very many clan bakes and stuff
like that.
You know?
unless there was ice cream being served.
Yeah, he'd definitely go to ice cream, you know, socials and everything. And that's something like an Italian restaurant, he'll go there.
Yeah, apparently like spaghetti bolognese, I think I read somewhere. Although, obviously, he had certain views about Italian people. Well, he had certain views about every type of person, let's be honest.
His wife was trying to like get him to be a little more open-minded, so deliberately took him to an Italian restaurant, you know, to kind of like, subject him to it. And so he'd like, and he fell in love with Italian food after that. And his views of Italians definitely changed over time.
Yes.
He said that he loved Italians because they treat their cats right. You know, that's the reason he can.
That was pretty much it. That was the Lovecraft key, wasn't it? Just go, look, I like cats. It's like, come in.
Yeah.
And he was obviously very much an Anglophile as well. Is that something that to you guys comes across? Do you feel his writing or his style is very English in a way? Or
oh yeah, you know? Yeah. I mean, just the way he writes, you know, his spelling of words, mm-hmm. you know, and like in the, and he used a lot of antiquarian, you know, words that you know that we always kind of associate kind of with colonial era. And he was definitely fascinated with the colonial era, especially you know the case of Charles Dexter Ward. And, he regarded himself as a Tory.
Definitely.
And that may not be just strictly just him. It may just be like a Rhode Island thing. Rhode Island was like one of the last to actually like, you know, to like join the United States of America.
Right.
So they're kind of like, you know, and for a long time, they didn't have their own constitution. They kind of like, you know, just, you know, almost like consider themselves still subject to the king.
Yeah.
So, you know, and so I imagine that probably some of that was going on with Lovecraft. You know, then he can't just, like everything else he does, he kind of like amplifies it, makes it his own thing.
And it's always interesting because he sort of harkens back to that past. Yet at the same time, you see, I think he even wrote somewhere about these sort of small puritanical communities that cut themselves off and gradually inbreed and degenerate. So it's an odd mixture of sort of conservatism with the small c, but at the same time saying that that leads to, well, sort of decay, really, and devolution.
Yeah, he had a lot of... I've been trying to figure that out, you know. It's like it seemed like he's very interested in being almost like, you know, exclusive and closed off, but at the same time, he deals with kind of all the mutations that are involved with that. And it, I don't know if that was something he dealt with all of his life, you know, trying like to figure out, you know, what's the seesaw balance of what he believes in.
Mm.
But, you know, like Arthur Jeremine, you know, the white ape story, he definitely had a lot of problems of, you know, kind of like hereditary, not being a part of a pure bloodline.
Well, I guess he always had that fear of, because obviously his father went insane, didn't he? Yeah. He always had that fear of madness, didn't he? I don't know, if they have like hereditary problems, because even his syphilis or something.
That's what they believe. I don't think it's actually ever been like, said he had syphilis. I think it's always been like, you know, he had the symptoms of it, so it must be it, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
It was that type of thing. And he was a traveling salesman, so you know that, you know, probably
with apologies to any traveling salesman who might be listening, we're sure you're totally faithful, lovely people.
Being stereotypical to a traveling salesman, you know.
Code of the road.
Yeah.
It's the code of the road, isn't it? What happens on the road stays on the road.
That's like a sort of running cliche joke in this country that if you're a lorry driver, you have a carpet in the back of the cab to roll the bodies of the hitchhikers. I mean, you know, it's kind of that same sort of thing. It's just one of those tropes. And it must be terrible if you are a lorry driver and put it in a nice person.
This is kind of the rep Uber drivers get around here, you know, some type of killer, you know.
This isn't my turn.
Yeah.
Scary stuff. So perhaps we could round off then with your favorite Lovecraft story, maybe least favorite as well.
I think because the first one that I read probably sticks out with the most with me is staying with my favorite, because I still like it, At the Mountains of Madness. And I think that's why I've still been, you know, Guillermo del Toro keeps teasing everyone with, I'm going to make a faithful version of this movie, you know, like that. And hoping that that's going to finally happen at some point, because that's the first one that that I read in that, again, in those collections of like Lovecraft stories and that type of thing. So there are other ones that probably at that same level, but as far as it just kind of, you know, making a first impression on you kind of thing, I think that's kind of like why it stuck with me as much as far as that goes. And then similarly, it's never, I don't think ever been, you know, as far as like adapted, you know, into anything, as far as that's why it continues to be the clamor, you know, the need, or, you know, the clamoring for, you know, them to make some kind of adaptation of it, because it's never, you know, of his stories, you know, they've never really, you know, that one, at least inside like a big budget movie or anything like that, hasn't been done. As far as the least favorite, I'd have to put some thought into that. There's ones that didn't really just kind of like, oh, I've kind of like, oh yeah, I think I read that one, or I forgot about that one, that kind of thing. But nothing that was kind of like, oh, this was bad. Or he should have, you know, this one should not have been published or anything like that.
I think that Mountains of Madness is the ideal one for a movie, really, isn't it? It's a movie length story already, and it's got so much going on in it. And with CGI now, the effects wouldn't be a problem.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's been done as far as, and we were talking about Lovecraftian video games, and as far as, you know, they were able to, you know, if they were able to do that again in a game, as far as then you can, you know, apply that, you know, same, you know, type of, because so many of those are about, like, us trying to immerse you in a cinematic experience to get into the Lovecraft type of world anyway, with these creatures and whatnot. And you can apply that and then put it in the hands of somebody like a Del Toro or somebody like that, who understands that aesthetic and those kind of stories. I think it should be something that I'm surprised hasn't been done by now.
There was actually a really good video game adaptation of Mountains of Madness called Conarium. Which came out. Conarium.
Oh, yeah.
It came out a couple of years ago. It's one of those narrative first-person things. There's a bit of light puzzling in it. There's a good old chase with the Shoggoth. It's really good. Yeah, it's Zoetrope Interactive, who've done a string of Lovecraftian games, but I think that was probably their best. It was really good, really atmospheric, really good, cool. Well recommended. I've got to ask, you were saying about Del Toro, after seeing Cabinets, are you sure you want him to do Mountains now?
I was going to say that too.
I'll give him a second chance. Because he didn't actually, he did that last one, the one with the...
No.
The one about the... There was that takeoff of the birds.
The murmurings or whatever.
Yeah. It was the somebody murmuring. Else who did, yeah. The misfire that was the Witch House, and then the other one, he was just a producer, so he's not at fault.
We'll give him a pass on that. Put him on notice, though. We're watching you, Del Toro.
You haven't jumped the shark yet, but you're getting close to it.
How about you, David? We're talking favorite Lovecraft story, and maybe least favorite as well, if such a thing exists.
Definitely Mountains of Madness, I guess, is my favorite. I love that story. Has so much depth to it. It's like you said, it's very cinematic. It's just dying to be adapted to a really good motion picture treatment. Least favorite is hard to decide. It's probably the horror at Red Hook. It was just one that didn't ever grab me as well as the others.
Yeah, I'll go along with that, actually. Yeah. How about you, Mark?
Favorite is probably the one that it's the one that got me hooked into Lovecraft. I was reading the Del Rey, the best of, but then when I got to this story, it was like, oh my God, this is what Lovecraft is. It was the Shalver Innsmouth. I just loved it. It was like, I could just picture everything, you know, especially like when it was like running through the town, and you know, I just loved it. And to me, it was like, I could see that being made into a movie. And Stuart Gordon did do a little adaptation to it with Dagon, which is not bad. Yeah. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I like that.
I would just say it was a faithful story. It wasn't like, you know, quite how I'd picture being a Lovecraftian story, but you know, if I consider one of my top favorite movies, you know, Dagon.
Yeah.
And then I'm gonna give you like two other ones. There was like the case of Charles Dexter Ward. I didn't like when I was little, but as I got older, I really loved it. So that's kind of a story, whereas I didn't like when I was, you know, like younger, but it seemed like as the older I got, I've appreciated more. And my least favorite is probably going to be like one of his ghost written stories, The Last Test.
Yeah.
That was the one I had the hardest time getting through, and I was glad when it was over, when it was done.
Yeah.
And I hated that one. So, you know, I wouldn't recommend that for anyone. You know, there's other ones, you know, like even Medusa's Coal, I'd probably recommend to people, you know, but I would give him definitely a warning of what's going on in that one, you know, but that's definitely one of his worst stories as well. But The Last Test, I think, is probably like the bottom of the barrel for me.
Yeah. I think the ghostwritten stuff can be interesting. I think most of the horror in the museum was quite enjoyable.
That was good.
Yeah.
Out of the Eons as well. And obviously Yig was I think that's probably my favorite, was the Curse of Yig of the ghostwritten ones.
Yeah. What'd you think of was it Out of the Eons with the killer fly? No. What was the one with the killer fly in it?
Oh, that's the Winged Death.
Winged Death, yes.
Yeah.
It has quite a ludicrous premise, but it works really well for what he did.
I suppose really when you consider across all his works, is remarkably consistent, given the fact that he seemed to spend most of his time writing letters as well. More time writing letters than stories, it must have been in a sense.
Yeah, it's like, I think one's like 78 pages. I think it was like, you know, it's like almost like unreal. It's like the length he'd go into, and just, it sometimes just be like, you know, just someone just wrote him. It's just like, just a fanboy. And he was like, just answer their questions right off the bat, you know. So, you know, and then, like, you know, like it's onto the wrong subject or something. He starts, like, you know, getting into, like, you know, tirades about certain things, you know.
I suppose there wasn't much else to do in those days, was there? There had no, very few distractions, I guess. Sure. He wasn't working as such, was he, I suppose? So.
Yeah, he never really had a 9-to-5 job whatsoever. So, you know. Now, he's supposed to have worked at a movie theater, you know, like a ticket taker or something like that at one time. Yeah. That's a legend talked about.
Yeah, I saw that. Someone mentioned that recently. I don't think the other interesting thing with Lovecraft, there seems to be no descendants or anything either. I'm assuming that there must have been some sort of estate when he passed away.
His aunt, one of his aunts was still alive. Yeah. And then, like, and most of his immediate family kind of like died off. He was almost like essentially the last Lovecraft.
Yeah, because it's not a name you hear anywhere else, is it? You know?
No. In fact, that'll be one of our future of podcast interviews, is Kenneth Page is going to delve into, like, you know, the Lovecraft name, you know, like, and how it died out and everything.
That'd be interesting. Yeah. And how do you, what sort of, you got that? Have you got other ideas lined up? And how do you choose your ideas? Is it something that just pops up, or have you got a sort of plan or structure in mind?
I have like kind of like a list of things I like, you know, people like to interview, and I kind of go like, well, I feel like I'm interviewing them right now. You know, there may be like something to just like kind of pique my interest at the moment, you know, to talk about them. And and sometimes, you know, like I like to like promote our home state. So we did one program about Irvin S. Cobb, you know, who's from Kentucky, and we did the Fishhead story, which Lovecraft really loved a lot. And also the other story he wrote, Broken Chain, which supposed been like the inspiration for Rats in the Wall. And they're really, really so different stories. You almost can't see how, you know, Lovecraft got an idea of a story out of it. And, but it's, you know, little things like that. And it's like there was like the Conan Festival was coming up in Texas, so we decided interview, like, and promote that. And there's certain people I just wanted to meet and see if it could be a good time to like interview them, like, you know, like Robert Price. I thought, like, for a second anniversary, interview him for that.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, long may it continue. It's one we certainly enjoy listening to. And I think we're going to have to start wrapping up, because I see it's the bus is pulling up outside, getting ready to take us back to Arkham. Of course, as guests, you get to stay here overnight. But
are you sure the bus is working?
We're never sure. Yeah. We're never sure about anything. The only thing you can be sure of in Innsmouth is that you can never be sure of anything. But I figure you've got numbers on your side, and in fact I was thinking with three of you could perhaps form some sort of three-lobed burning eye, perhaps to keep things at bay.
that'd be good. We'll
If any of you got any booze on you, I could bribe Zadok Allen to bring a ladder around your back to the back room so you can make a quick getaway.
We got some good old bourbon, you know. We can.
You'll be sorted then. You'll be sorted. You'll do whatever you like. Yeah.
But we do have one last task before we leave. The more observant amongst you may have noticed Tim lugging that huge, heavy object, bumpety bump, up the stairs.
Oh, yes. It's bulbous and swollen again. It's not been emptied in a while, has it? So here we go. Here's Dagon's sack, gentlemen. Take a good look.
Stand back.
Dagon's sack. Which of you would like to volunteer to place your arm in there and pull out a letter for us? Any takers?
Sure, I'll go for it.
There we go. Brave man is a brave man.
Yeah, wow, this is not catching, is it?
It's all right. There's jabs are available and cream and all sorts. So. Okay, so let's see what we've got. We've got a question here from Jay in Norwich. And Jay says, what are you guys reading at the moment? And do you have any good recommendations? Thank you, Jay, for that question. So, Tim.
Indeed, I'm actually reading one of the older Arkham horror novels that I managed to actually finally track down. It's called The Dance of Death or something, I think it's called. I can't remember off the top of my head what it's actually called. But yeah, it's not the current run. It's one of the older ones. I've been trying to track down the old paperbacks. It's the first in one of the trilogies. But yeah, it's very good so far. It's I like them Arkham horror novels. They kind of do what they say on the tin. But because I'm into the living card game, so it's nice to, you know, read these sort of backstories to the characters that you play. It's kind of cool when you look at them from that kind of perspective. But I just recently finished In a Dark Place, the Carl Edward Wagner collection, which has just had the reissue. It's just been reprinted for the first time in God knows how long with a nice new foreword from Ramsey Campbell. And so I definitely recommend that. That's definitely worth picking up.
How about you guys? You got any recommendations?
You got a little something here.
It's like I just happened to be reading of this one, Far Below, the stories of Robert Barber Johnson. He was a Weird Tale writer as well. And Lovecraft wrote to him and they wrote back for a little bit. And he's a Kentuckian as well. And so he wrote the story Far Below is kind of like almost like a prequel sequel to Pickman's Model. And he basically wrote a story about one of the paintings, you know, the event inspired one of the paintings that Pickman painted.
That's not a name I'm familiar with, that one. That's what was the name again? Sorry, Emma.
Robert Barber Johnson. Robert Johnson.
Excellent.
And Far Below and Other Weird Stories.
Nice. Definitely have to pick that up.
And that one was considered kind of like a tribute to Lovecraft because he wrote that after he died. And so he kind of like... Josie really likes it. He thought really highly of it. He thought he thought it was a guy who was writing Lovecraftian fiction in the right way, that he didn't necessarily try to imitate a style. You know, he just kind of like took elements of it to write his own story and just peppered it in there.
Yeah.
But he's not overt, you know, with a lot of the Cthulhu mythos. He kind of like just sneaks them in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is the best way to do it, I think, isn't it? When it's that more subtle approach, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not with the Durlethian shopping lists.
Yep. Would you, Richard?
Are you guys familiar with Garth Marenghi's Dark Place?
Oh, yes.
Indeed. I picked up Garth Marenghi's Terror Tome over the holidays. I started reading that in the last couple of weeks, and about halfway through that. That's really, really good. Because I missed that show, that there weren't more episodes of it. And this feels so good. Like, you know, the novelization almost, because he's writing it in character as Garth Marenghi. Yeah. So he's very dismissive and insulting to the reader. And and he self-inserts himself into the book or whatever, and is talking about his flowing mane of hair and his animal magnetism to the women and all that.
We actually had tickets to go and see him live. He was doing readings from the book.
Oh, that's
but
cool.
Long story short, we had an awful night trying to find our way around Birmingham, and there was fireworks going on and all sorts. And we never actually got to the venue, so we missed it. But
When you're stuck in some weird, like, stuck in that hellish ring road for hours.
it felt like we were stuck in hell.
Yeah. I lived there for 5 years. I can tell you, that's pretty much the closest you'll ever get to being in hell, is that ring road in Birmingham. The roads, man. Spaghetti Junction. I mean, what sadist created Spaghetti Junction?
But yeah, Garth Marenghi. Yeah, I've not actually got that yet, but that is on the list, that book. And it's we've not really covered Dark Place, have we, Tim?
We should. Yeah, we should cover that.
Yeah, there's a full on Lovecraft parody in the series finale. Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. The broccoli from Yorgos or something.
The moss, the moss from Yorgos or whatever.
How about you, David?
I just recently read, I think it's a reworking of Who Goes There by John W. Campbell. It's called Frozen Hell. It's expanded the original story somewhat. And I don't know if it came before or after The Thing by Carpenter, but it's about three. I listened to it on audio. It was about 3 hours long. It's worth a listen if you enjoyed the original story and you like The Thing. It's got it gives you a little bit of perspective on the other side of it, I guess. And then today, since I had a long drive, I picked out an audiobook to listen to, and I'm not sure what I think of it yet. It's called The Weird of Holly and Book One, Innsmouth, and it's by John Michael Greer. And it's a bit
that one.
It's a bit dirt. It's a bit like some August Derleth stuff that I've read, because it's sort of splitting the mythos into good people or good guys and bad guys, or at least guys that aren't as bad as some others and that kind of thing. So I'm not finished, so the jury's out. But I mean, it's not horrible, but I don't know exactly where it's going, and it's a two more books or three more books. I don't know if I'll be there for the rest.
Oh, you're stuck now. You're in a series. Yeah. Well,
I stick that book one.
Don't turn it back.
You've got to keep going.
That's it. I've just finished reading a book called The House of the Wolf by Basil Copper.
Ah, nice.
Again, is another author that we keep meaning to cover, who's written quite a few Lovecraftian short stories. And this was recommended. So it's a novel, quite a lengthy novel as well. And it's pure gothic werewolf melodrama set in a castle in Hungary, and everyone is snowed in and there's a possible werewolf on the prowl, et cetera, et cetera. And it's got some great illustrations in it as well. It's a really nicely produced book. And I think I've read one or two Basil Copper short stories before, but
Shaft 34 or whatever.
Yeah, was it Cthulhu 2000 or one of those anthologies, wasn't it? I think
it's a really good one.
Yeah, so definitely someone we want to cover. So yeah, that would be my recommendation. But that's great. Thanks for that, guys. We've got some good new names there to check
definitely.
Out. And we'll certainly be putting those on the list. Speaking of which, that's what we're going to be doing for next time is giving our patrons a poll. We're going to give you a choice of four titles that we haven't quite decided yet. Perhaps we'll put one or two of these on, eh, Tim?
Yeah, why not?
And, and that is the particular story we'll be covering next time. So there we go. Thanks hugely, guys, again for coming in and braving the Innsmouth mists and braving the Innsmouth night. We hope you make it out. Sure you will.
Safety numbers, Beth.
you seem like adaptable and resolute chaps. So, you're Kentuckians, right?
Yes. We got our gun racks going on. So.
If in doubt, just head for the railroad tracks. You'd find then find some weeds to lie until morning. You know.
Yeah. Apparently, they don't like the weeds in Innsmouth.
Innsmouth weeds. So there's an idea. Innsmouth weeds.
I did a story called Innsmouth Acid once, which was set in the 60s. But that was,
yes, yeah. I've read that. Yeah.
All right. So thanks, everyone, for listening today. As always, if you do have any questions or comments or suggestions for the show, do drop us a line at dagonsack@outlook.com. or via our Facebook or Patreon pages. And if you'd like to sign up to our Patreon page and help support the show, you can do so at three tiers of membership. As I've been saying every episode for the past six now, we are restructuring the tiers. We will get around to that at some point. You do get free entry to the Innsmouth Literary Festival as a patron. So if for nothing else, it's worth signing up for that, if nothing else. All right. That's it for today. Thanks again for listening. With that, it's goodbye from me, Rob Hoyton.
And it's goodbye from me, Tim Mendes.